Kitty Hart Moxon is a name that many people know and many others know but can't quite place. Though now she lives in Harpenden in Hertfordshire, she was born in Poland. Her autobiographies, I Am Alive and Return to Auschwitz, are just a small part of her work over the past 70 years, in which she's been committed to the view that everyone should know what happened in the Holocaust and why it's important to know so that it can't happen again. She's written and broadcast so much about her 7 years on the run, in hiding, after capture, in the ghetto, in the camps, and the death march. But she's not really spoken at length about her commitment to tell, to explain, and to educate over the last 70 years. So that's what we agreed to discuss. Thank you very much, Kitty Hart Moxon, for allowing us into your home. Just let me remind our listeners that you live in Harpenden, and yes. You've lived here for how many years?
About 10 years.
And you moved here because?
I had to move. I was a bit isolated in Birmingham when my husband died, and my family live here, and so it was logical for me to move, yes.
Right. And of course, you're very well known locally, and you appear frequently in the local newspapers as well as the national and the international press. And we know of you. You are formally described as a speaker on the Holocaust issues. You survived the Holocaust yourself. Tell me when that started for you, because presumably at the end of the war you were coming out of that situation. What led you to where you are now?
No, I started at Liberation. I was working for the Quaker relief teams in a displaced persons camp, and I decided I've got to start documenting because my story was so complicated. So many things happened. Every day had a different situation for 7 years. And I realized that my mother survived with me. And I thought, well, while we're both of us here, I've got to do some documentation because I shall need it, because I made a commitment, whatever I'm going to do in my life, I have to make sure that people understand what had happened. And I had a pretty awful time when I came to England, and that proved the right approach.
You were in a displaced persons camp after the war because there were millions of people moving around Europe.
There were 9 million people, 9 million people displaced in Germany. And because my mother taught English before the war, and she knew England very well, she studied an English degree, she was asked to become an interpreter, and I could just about speak a little bit, not very well, because I was brought up three languages, and my parents thought, you know, English is just too much, that can wait.
And you were still at this time a teenager?
Yes, I was a teenager, that's right.
So had you missed a whole period of school, as it were?
I missed from the age of 12 to 19. I missed my whole teens. You know, and that's why my parents thought at 12 I had to cope with three languages. I shouldn't be lumbered with English as well, although I went to English nursery school. So it was in my head, you know. So after the war, my mother became an interpreter for the British Army on the Rhine, and she took me along, and I started interpreting as well. And we were asked to help the Quaker relief teams to run a displaced persons camp. Now, it was the largest displaced persons camp in the British zone, outside Brunswick, in fact, at the airport of Brunswick. They took that over. It was like a little town. And it was mostly a Polish camp, because Quakers couldn't communicate, not with the Poles, not with the Germans. So we were absolutely essential. And I was there almost 2 years. And at that point, I began documenting.
What were you documenting? Your story or other people's story?
Purely documenting what happened to my mother and myself, to my family, to one family. I didn't look at the history or anything like that. There was just too much.
What was in your mind? What made you think you wanted to document this?
I don't know. I realised that because there was so much, in time I will not remember it all. And I thought, well, no, that must not happen. And it proved me right, because when I came over to the UK, I had the most horrendous time. We had an uncle, my mother's brother-in-law, in fact, was my uncle. And he picked us up from Dover, and on the way to Birmingham, not long into the journey, he said, "Remember, in my house, I don't want you to speak about anything that happened to you. I don't want to know, and I don't want my girls, my two cousins, upset." And, you know, that set the scene of what happened to me when I came over. There was no benefit, no help, nothing. not from my family, not from the state, not from the local authorities, and not from the Jewish community. And I was angry because of that. I wasn't angry at what had happened to me. I was angry at what happened after the war, and because people didn't want to know.
Did you work out after why they didn't want to know?
Well, I did work out that it had a lot not just to do with the fact that they had enough of the war, but all the killing centres and the ghettos were behind the Iron Curtain. The people simply didn't know what was going on behind the Iron Curtain. How would they? There was no communication. So that sets me off. And I made this commitment that no matter what I was going to do in my life, which I had no idea at that point, I wanted to go back to school, couldn't do that because there was no one to finance me. You know, it was just incredibly difficult. And so I actually, while I was training, eventually I was training to be a radiographer. You know, it's too long a story to tell you how I come to do that. That I decided, no matter what I do, this is what I've got to do. So I started by, now you're going back to about 1948-49. I started by making contact with the Auschwitz Museum that was just established. Former prisoners established that museum. Now, again, it was difficult, it was all under communism. But I did make contact, and I would send them tea and coffee, because they were very short of that. It was no good sending them money. They couldn't buy anything. And in return, I asked for documents, photographs, anything that they had, you know, like copies of, would they let me have it? And this is what actually, that was the start of it. I had all, because I had nothing. I was liberated practically naked and barefoot. So I had nothing. Not even my own photographs, I'm sorry. And so what happened? The first thing that happened, I asked them, could they send me the stuff? And I was going to make an exhibition and see if I can put it together and perhaps go into schools. So, because I didn't know how to go about it, so I went to the Birmingham University students, took all my stuff, and they made me great big placards. And I began going into school. I wasn't always welcome, I must tell you that. Sometimes people say, no, we don't want to hear it. Oh, it's too controversial, you know. We don't want it. But very often they did. And that's how I started. I was going, that went through the 50s. In the meantime, I had a young family. My mother came to live with us. And I was working all hours of the day and night, you could say. So anyway, so that got off the ground. And then because I had all this documentation, I decided, well, I'm going to publish a book. And so I published my first book in 1961, which was called I'm Alive. And that's where I had this very bad experience in America, where they said, oh, the subject's not for the 60s and the 70s. It's finished with, you know, made me even more angry and decided I was going to do even more. Anyway, the book went quite well and people got really interested. And the next thing that happened is I persuaded the Auschwitz Museum to bring over an exhibition themselves, which they did, brought it to Birmingham. I formed a small committee. And this exhibition went off, and we couldn't find a venue for it. The Birmingham Education Committee didn't want it. They said it's too controversial. We had it all lined up in the art gallery, Birmingham Art Gallery. No, they wouldn't have it. But we had some church people with us, and Jim Thompson, who was a bishop of Stepney, got to know about this, and he said he'll have the exhibition. So we toddled up to London, took the exhibition to London, and, you know, people queuing right around, and we had it in the crypt, just to be on the safe side. When the exhibition finished, we brought it back to Birmingham, we crated it, and the next thing that happened, the National Front got in and burnt some of the exhibits, because the Poles were absolutely furious and decided they wanted it back. And if you go to the Auschwitz Museum in Auschwitz today, there's a book which actually described what had happened. But I carried on.
And were you working alone, or by now had you? You said you'd formed a committee.
Yes, we had just about three or four people that I persuaded to come in together, so, because it was too much for me to do. I was working practically full time in hospitals, you know, and I couldn't do it all myself. I didn't have a secretary to do it. So yes, that's what happened, and I went on like this for some time, and then my book was picked up, obviously, and I was asked to do a big film called Return to Auschwitz. Well, the film director wanted to do this film with me. He'd been went all over the world, but came back to me. He came back via Martin Gilbert. I don't know if you know about Martin Gilbert. Martin and I worked together for many years. So Martin said, yes, she'll do it for you. And I said, well, look, I will only do it if I can go back to Auschwitz and do it there. I'm not going to sit in the studio and talk about Auschwitz because the people are not going to understand it. You've got to physically put your foot in the place before you can begin to understand anything. So this is what we did. We did this film, and it was like a bombshell. People had never seen it before. I was the first survivor to go from the West.
This was presumably a film to go on television. Was that what it was for?
It was a Yorkshire Television. It was their most successful production that they've ever done. They've sold it all over the world. I got nothing, but, I mean, they made a lot of money. And I said, I'll only do it if I can go back. Well, they didn't want me to. They said, no, we can't take it back. No, it was all under communism. However, they negotiated with the Polish government, and the Poles were jubilant. They wanted the film done because nobody had been to do anything, you know. And the place was totally deserted. And we had a lot of help from the Poles. So that's what happened. I went back I went at my first return. I was quite emotional because my first return. And I was let loose there. I wasn't directed in any way. I had to find everything, which was quite difficult. It all looked different. It all was green. And before it was all mud, you can imagine. It looked totally different. But it was the most successful film. It won 6 international awards and the World Prize in Tokyo as one of the best documentary. So it was a great success. And then people came to me, now you've got to write another book. Got it? So I sat down and wrote Return to Auschwitz, and I've been revising it, you know, re-editing it. In fact, it needs doing again. But the last edition I did is in 2007. So it's, you know, it's pretty recent.
Does that book describe any of your emotions about going back, or is it just that?
There's just too much. I mean, there's a limit how much you can do, you know. So when I speak, I very often speak about other things that are in the book. And people say, well, it's not in your book. I said, well, everything we've written, you couldn't read it. It'd be just too much. I was in Auschwitz nearly 2 years. I went through 4 prisons and 7 camps over 7 years. On the ghetto, on the death march, I was sentenced to death, to be executed by firing squad. I couldn't get it all in, not in detail. So that is why I keep revising as I go along. And then the next thing that happened, I went to New York. I went all through America with the film. It was a huge, I wouldn't say success, it was just a bombshell also in America. All the survivors wanted to speak with me because, you know, I suddenly come to life. And a lot of people that I've been with in different places.
Were there by that stage survivor organizations, survivor groups?
Well, they were better. They were far better in the USA than they were here. They were much more advanced. Reason being, simply, there were more survivors there. Our survivors were concentrated in London. Birmingham had 3 survivors, and one was a 15-year-old. She couldn't do much. She couldn't do very much. So, and one didn't do anything because Paul Oppenheimer, he was working. So I was pretty well on my own. You know, I had to do it all myself. So the next thing that happened in America, while I was in the States, well, lots of things happened in the States, but one of the interesting things happened that some man wanted to come and see me while I was in the hotel. Well, my hotel switchboard was jammed with all these people trying to get in touch. And it was a film producer for Universal Films, and he walked into the room and he pointed his finger. He said, "I want you." I said, what can I do for you? You know. He said, well, I'm doing a film called Sophie's Choice, and I want you to be the technical advisor. So that was the next thing that happened. I went with them. I was on my way to Denver to meet Simon Wiesenthal, who, remember, was a so-called Nazi hunter, and we were doing a project in Denver. I said, look, I've got to finish what I'm doing before I go back. And I'm actually working. You know, I'm a working person. I had to get time off. And then I flew out. We did it outside Zagreb. And I did Sophie's Choice. So that was 1981. And from then on, I did so many other things, like, I don't know whether you've seen any of them, I did something with Channel 4 called Another Journey, where I went back to Auschwitz with four neo-Nazis, and I was really cross because they walked out on me while we were in the camp. And we continued filming.
They walked on you because they didn't like what you said?
They knew very well. There was a German, an Austrian, a French, and a boy from Glasgow. And the worst one was the Glasgow boy, because of free speech, he could say anything. The German was slightly afraid, you see, and the French wasn't allowed to say too much either. And the German said, come on, we've had enough now, we're off. And they walked out on us, on the film crew. So that was that. The next thing that came up, we're going into the 80s, was a Holocaust Educational Trust. Now, I don't know if you recall, but there was the War Crimes Bill, which they only prosecuted one man. It didn't go completely through the Lords, did it? But two of the Lords decided they got to do something, so they established the Holocaust Educational Trust. And I was asked to bring my film, Return to Auschwitz, which was shown in Westminster. And they wanted me to come and on the board of management and be a trustee. So that was happened next. Lord Melvin Rees, he was the Home Secretary at that point. So that came next. And the next thing.
And what was their objective? They wanted.
Oh well, their objective was to establish Holocaust education in schools. And the most successful thing that happened is that they got it into the schools. That was the Thatcher government at that time, and it was somebody called Patton, was it? Mm. He was the Secretary of State for Education. We got it into the school national curriculum, and that actually started the ball rolling.
Next time in this two-part interview, Kitty talks about her work with the Holocaust Education Trust, which she calls HET, and about much else in recent decades, including her astonishing and unexpected encounter with the House of Commons on her 90th birthday. Kitty's story of her years under the Nazis is told in two books, I Am Alive and Return to Auschwitz. It's also told in many film and TV documentaries.